Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We got power.
Stop the bumps and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
We for unity.
Stop the bumping and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, the priest with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the bumping and the fighting.
Right now. Right now.
Now the time to do the right thing. Do it right now. We got to do it right.
Right now. Right now.
That's right. That's right. We are going to do it right. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. We are here live at Harris Stowe State University, our only Black historical university and college. So we are glad to be here. The opinions expressed on the show today are those of me. And not necessarily those of Harris Stowe State University or Black Radio Hall of Fame. So, and we always have a lot to talk about, and sometimes it is controversial. And so, but hopefully today's show will not be that, because this is truly about history and facts. So, this is the place where we come together and we talk about those people who've been on the battlefield. And, sometimes they're fighting for healthcare. They're fighting for police accountability. They're fighting for housing. I mean, it's just so many fronts that we have to fight on. And so my job is to bring those people to you so you could hear their stories. And they're not always from St. Louis. They're from all over, so that you could see our struggles are connected. And in some ways, they are based on the same system of oppression. So we have to understand that everywhere in this country and the world, there are people fighting for justice. They're fighting for democracy. They're fighting for dignity. So we are honored today to have in the studio Ben Phillips. And Ben Phillips, I can say without going through his exhaustive bio that I would say over being an engaged person in the appointed positions, he's held elected positions, he's just been all around. And so here is somebody that has a vested interest in this community. So welcome, Ben.
Thank you, Jamala.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the reasons that I wanted you to come is because as of this month, 50 years ago, the last resident of Pruitt-Igoe moved out. And that was after a rocky start of a housing project that had been touted as, you know, the best thing since sliced bread, and how that happened, I don't know, because almost from the very beginning, it seemed like it was doomed. And so I just want to give our listeners a little bit of history about Pruitt-Igoe. And then, if you would, Ben, you can fill in because you actually live there. So this was a housing, idea that came out, based on really trying to look at what do you do with poor people in the city. And in St. Louis, around that time, you know, this was after World War II, you know, people were trying to find affordable housing, and there was not much. And so they came up with the idea to do these, what I would say, a very ambitious project. And they got funding for it. And so construction began in 1951. And the first tenants moved in 54. But almost from the very beginning, I would say even before tenants started moving in, and this is part of the racist nature of our system and the classist nature of it, here were some buildings that was designed by a world-renowned architect who's attached his name to this project. and had some issues from the very beginning, but because he could see that what was being asked of him was not really going to work, but he went on and proceeded anyway. So you have these 33 buildings. I mean, they took up a huge part of the city, some 57 acres. These buildings were 11 stories. I mean, at its height, there was probably about, I think it was 10,000 people there, 20,000 people living there. So this was a huge project. But one of the things that started happening early on is they started cutting corners on the construction. And to me, this is serious, because anytime you got this many buildings that go that high, you need to be concerned about safety. You need to be concerned about the longevity of the building, the families. And so I think for me, when I heard about the skip-stop elevators, I'm like, who does that? Where do you see anywhere in a building that's going to be more than 5-6 stories high that you skip floors to save money and have people walking up those steps? I mean, it was just ridiculous. But these were the compromises that were being made along the way. So quite naturally, over time, those gangways became places where, you know, people were mugged, robbed, or whatever. And then the other thing that happened almost immediately was the withdrawing of funds for maintenance issues. And that's a killer for any housing development, whether it's a high rise or not. The same thing happened with, what was the one down here, down the street here? No, not the Blue Mire. This was one the that Clay, was mixed income.
The Clay Town.
The Clay Town. That started happening. At one point, that was like touted as like mixed income, you know, intergenerational, multiracial. And then they said they started incentivizing not taking care of the place. So you would get money if you didn't take care of it. And so the maintenance issues is what caused the deterioration, both in terms of, you know, who was moving in there, the quality of the buildings themselves. But, you know, most people, when they first heard about Pruitt-Igoe, they thought it was going to be okay. Now, keep in mind, and Ben, you and I went over this before the show started, William Igoe was supposed to be for the white folks.
Correct.
Wendell Pruitt was supposed to be for the black folks. But by the time they built the buildings, the equal housing protection and all of that good stuff said, no, you can't do that. And so they opened it up and started switching families back and forth. So at a while, obviously, it became predominantly black. And that's how I think most of us remember Pruitt-Igoe is poor black people. But that's not the way it started out. Your family was one of the families that moved in. What was it like when you moved in?
It was, well, we came from a, what they call a shotgun cold water flat with an outhouse. At the time when we moved into Pruitt-Igoe, there was me, my mom, dad, a little brother and a sister. So there were five of us moving in. But it was like Shangri-La. I mean, you know, we come from a pot-bellied stove house with an outhouse, a number 10 foot tub as the bathtub.
Uh-huh.
So having our own private bathrooms and stuff of that nature, I mean, it was like, and have a radiator heat. You know, we were using coal as a heating source. So, and the ice man would bring back the 5 pounds of ice, whatever it was, and we put it in front of some kind of a window or something, let the air blow across to cool it off. So it was a very much a step up for me and my family.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm the oldest in the family, so I had a few older kids view
mm-hmm.
and my little brothers and
mm-hmm.
sisters.
Mm-hmm. But from what I heard from people who, the first to move in, they almost claimed it was a penthouse. I mean, according to you, you know, it was a step up from what they had, and so it was quite a project to be a part of. But here's the thing that also happened, and you can speak to this, is that one of the policies, and this just goes with the failed housing policy of the U.S. HUD and the rest of these folks, they determined that fathers couldn't live there. And I know Sylvester Brown talks about this issue and many other folks that males could not be living in that. So in essence, the housing policy resulted in the destruction of black families just by that policy alone. And so what was that like when you all were told, oh, dad can't, you all can come, but dad can't come?
Well, when we first moved in, that was not the policy. That evolved.
Okay.
You know, which I think is part of the systemic racism, whatever you want to call it, that eventually they started saying that to people. My father lived with us the entire time we were in Puerto Rico, from 1954 to 1967. And there were other families that I was close with. The fathers were always there, or at least there was some man who was there. But I started hearing about the welfare system, saying the fathers can't live there, and men were hiding, and, you know, and not don't open the door for anybody, you know, people like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't face that. I started seeing it later on when I became a teenager.
Mm.
But by that time, my dad was saying, but he may be known that. I'm not sure. He never discussed it with me. But one day I was walking when he said, you know, this is not the place we moved into. And within 6 months to a year, we were gone.
Okay.
But, I think that those, policies were in place, but it just hadn't pulled the trigger on them, and it caused some problems. A big problem we had at Pruitt-Igoe was in 1959, there was a huge tornado. It tore up all around Pruitt-Igoe, Sheridan and Gamble and Dayton across Jefferson, and they had to supply emergency housing for these people who were displaced, which, you know, that's what you're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
But they never had an exit plan for them. And the projects, as we call them, they would start demanding rents, and the rents got higher. But if you got people who don't have a house and have no job, they can't pay rent. So
and just be clear for my listeners, being the people who were in the surrounding areas who were impacted by the tornado were moved into Pruitt-Igoe as housing, temporary housing.
Correct.
Wow.
Correct. So then I guess they just punished us. If you couldn't pay the rent, they cut back on the maintenance.
Mm.
And that's what led to a lot of problems in Pruitt-Igoe, the lack of maintenance.
Yeah, yeah. So when you have a lack of maintenance, and I remember reading about there were women on each floor that just got together and swept and cleaned up. And I'm thinking, what? You know, you paying rent and you got to clean up common areas that are supposed to be taken care of by a maintenance guy. But yet, you know, you were still getting punished in so many ways. I just think that what I've seen with public housing is the maintenance has to be maintained. I mean, the minute you start acting like these people are not deserving of safe, clean, and sanitary conditions, then all bets are off. I mean, really, it's sad. And I think we've seen that even with subsidized institutions like senior citizen places. I mean, we saw it with Northview Village. I mean, you got to maintain a level of humane standards for people to thrive in. And I just think that when they started cutting back on the monies for public housing, that was the first to go was the maintenance. And that was really, really sad. But you know, what's interesting, when I talk to students, particularly students who are going into social work, who are dealing with policy, and I always ask them, do they know about the policy where men could not be part of a family? And most of them don't. So it seems to me that would be like a thing that you get taught as part of the history of social work so that you can understand better why single female-headed households became a thing. It wasn't on their own that all of a sudden we didn't have like daddies. It was like, if you don't live in this project, this home, no man can be here. And that's when you start to have folks, you know, try to be deceptive so that they can have the father in the house. When they knew somebody was coming, they hid all the men clothes. They had to tell the kids lie. I mean, it was really not fair. It was just not fair. So what do you think the impact of that policy alone had on the residents of Pruitt-Igoe?
I think it was terrible. I mean, taking a black man away from his family, and then they turned turn the table saying, oh, they just don't like being fathers. They don't care about the children. They don't care about the women. Well, it wasn't that. It was that they did care. That's why they had to leave. And they left voluntarily. Some of them, you know, he had people around. But they knew that if they stayed there, not only them, but their families would be out on the street.
Yeah, so they knew they would jeopardize.
They would jeopardize.
Yeah, wow. To me, just thinking about that being, because nowhere was that policy ever explained publicly. And so the conclusion is what you just said, that black men are trifling, they deadbeat daddies, and they don't care, when really they were forced out of the homes. And the policy persisted for decades. And so you had intergenerational families without fathers, and now we are penalized for that policy as if we created it and created our own reality in that sense. So I really did want people to know about that, because I still think that folks don't know that that was a policy. That was not something that black folks made up and decided, oh, I don't want to be with my family. They were forced out by policy and public housing. And you know, to me, that was also part of the doom of Pruitt-Igoe. You know, you got that going on, and then you got the lack of responsiveness to repairs. I mean, people were living, it's really in substandard conditions after a while.
You know, it took a while for that to happen, because one thing I will say, those buildings were well built. The construction issue was about the heating and cooling system.
Yeah,
well, there
yeah.
was no cooling system.
Right, it was heating.
Hot water or steam.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the fight that cost a lot of money, I was told. But the buildings were sturdy. I mean, they had to blow them up. You know, they bombed them, basically, to tear them down, most of them. But deterioration, window repair, you know, you start having windows getting broken. You see a piece of plywood up at the windows, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's about the time my daddy said, we got to get out.
But
we were fortunate that my father had a job.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the folks didn't have a job, or had a job like my father. And, you know, it just...
You stuck.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you stuck.
Yeah.
You stuck. And I just want to say something about the cooling piece, because it wasn't until a few years ago that people in public housing couldn't even have air conditions, even if somebody gave them one for their window. They were like, no, if you can afford an air conditioner, you don't need to be here. What?
That's a heck of an attitude.
That's a heck of an attitude. I mean, what the hell? You can't be cool in the St. Louis heat, because that's a luxury. That's
right.
Not a, and we know now that it's not a luxury. It's like you need to have air conditioning. Now you got agencies that provide air conditioning, because it gets that hot with the global warming and all the other stuff. But in a certain point, it's like you don't deserve to be cool in the summertime.
Slavery. I mean, you know, that's what they want to put you as a slave. That attitude still persists,
yeah.
Even now, the way things are happening in this world. You know, we back to the Ku Klux Klan era.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely. But, you know, when folks started moving out or being forced out, you know, they were made certain promises of where they could go or should go. And what we saw happening behind the scenes was a total disinvestment in public housing by HUD, the Department of Housing. And I don't think that little memo trickled down to people, but it's like, we ain't trying to do this no more. You know, Pruitt-Igoe was a definite public humiliation of that agency. But it wasn't because of the tenants. It's because of the way that they built that stuff and the way that they operated. And so they had that to live, you know, be in their face for a long time. And I can tell you so many studies, there's about why it failed. And so that's going to be around for a long time. It just was a messed up policy of first of all, putting that many people together. Because, Ben, I can remember when I was in college, our BSA, the Black Student Association, got a hold of a document that talked about a study of how they use rats and looked at rats when you put them on top of each other. And they became almost neurotic. And so, you know, some of us were from urban cities, from Chicago and Philly, and all of those places had high-rise, projects, Cabrini-Green, so we started to say, wait a minute, this is how they basing public housing on a study based on rats being piled on top of each other. So for us, even as young adults, we knew this was wrong, it was inhumane, and I think since then, when they talk about public housing, it really is like no more than three or four stories. Sometimes it's just townhouses right. that are, quote, public housing. But I would say that for the folks who were in Pruitt-Igoe and the folks who were in Carr Square.
Yeah,
they were promised stuff with Hope 6 that, they were going to be able to come back and they were going to get... None of that really happened. And so it's just always this continuing policies and procedure and practices that really don't honor black folks or poor folks having decent housing. Is that your view as well?
Yeah, I mean, they just don't care about you as a human being. It makes it hard on you. It's hard to do anything without the thumb coming down on you. We've all faced it. I mean, you've been in the struggle a long time. I've been out there, so we've had our hits on just trying to make sure survival is okay for people. And we're still fighting it.
Yeah. And so one of the reasons that also I wanted Ben to join us today is because the legacy of Pruitt-Igoe is still ongoing. I know we talked about the bad publicity, but there was also something that happened to the tenants in terms of poisoning. And I know that at some point there was these chemical warfare testing that came out of the Cold War. And you and others, Chester Deans in particular, created an organization called
FACTS.
And it's a mouthful, so I want you to say what the acronym stands for.
Pruitt-Igoe Historic Accountability Compensation Truth Seeking.
Yeah. So that's FACTS. And so that they were about really trying to get to the bottom of this poisoning. So tell us about when you all found out that you were poisoned by the U.S. government and what it's been like to that struggle for acknowledgement, first of all, and compensation. And I would just say I've introduced my listeners to some of this because I had, somebody from the Tularosa Downwinders Consortium. This is a group that got a little bit of publicity when Oppenheimer movie came out, because for the most part, Americans have been told the reason they chose that particular testing site is because there were no human beings there. Well, that was a bold-faced lie. And so Tina Cordova came on and she talked about that, and the whole damn town, all of them have cancer of some sort. And yet the U.S. government is still reluctant to admit that there was error and that folks need to be compensated. So, so talk about what happened to Pruitt-Igoe tenants with the U.S. government testing, using them as test subjects.
Well, the way I found out about it, my daughter called me and said, Dad, a lady's on TV running, talking about Pruitt-Igoe, and there was some spraying in Pruitt-Igoe. The lady was Lisa Martino Taylor. She was doing her dissertation on aerosol poisoning, and Pruitt-Igoe was the location that she was working. I got to know Dr. Lisa pretty well. I went down to the public library where she was speaking, and we formed a relationship. And she's maybe the foremost authority on aerosol spraying in the United States. She just recently moved from St. Louis to Connecticut. I guess she knew the air was fresh up there or something.
Yeah.
But she moved. But we still in touch. In fact, I'm trying to get here on July the 11th. We have a documentary that she, I, and a young man named Damian D. Smith put together. He's originally from St. Louis. He's out in Los Angeles now, but he's a documentary producer. And so at the History Museum on July 11th, 5 o'clock, we're going to have the viewing of Target St. Louis, Volume 1. Mm. It's an award-winning production. It's won 6 or 7 awards, national awards.
And if you all haven't seen it, you got to see it because it really explains the whole story.
It does. It walks it down. And what people don't realize that it was impacted by the Manhattan Project.
Mm.
You know, they were putting up radiation and aerosol in the air, and they were trying to develop non-bombing offensive weapons against Russia. St. Louis housing stock was very similar to Moscow, Leningrad, St. Petersburg. So,
is that because of the bricks?
Because of the bricks and stone.
Mm-hmm, bricks and stone.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So they chose Pruitt-Igoe site. Now, it's not just Pruitt-Igoe that's contaminated. You're talking about Carscoe Village, the whole area around Pruitt-Igoe has some type of radiation or poisoning going on within it. So, but they never would tell us why,
Of course not.
And what, one of our slogans is, what we don't know can hurt us and continue hurting us for some time, possibly for as long as we live.
I was going to say, what you don't know can kill you.
What you don't know can kill you.
Absolutely.
And so we're still digging into it. Lisa Martino got her PhD, but she's done an additional 5 years of study on this aerosol spraying. And, it creates a lot of different types of cancer, lung cancer, liver cancer. I had a benign tumor in my ear. They don't know where it come from. But luckily, it was benign. It wasn't cancer. But my mom and my grandmother died of cancer. And probably 6 or 7 out of every 10 people that I know when I go to a funeral that grew up in that area, they died of cancer. And I had already started thinking about that when I was a youngster, but she confirmed that there is a real problem. And the federal government still won't come clean saying that they did it.
So here's the thing. Has anybody from Pruitt-Igoe ever been tapped to say, we want to study the long-term impacts of what happened? Because they know that something happened. That's not to be disputed.
Oh, yeah.
So has anybody said, let's look at the impact? Or they just say, the hell with y'all,
They say, the hell with y'all. We say, we want it. And we've had batteries of lawyers and attorneys going after this. In fact, a young man named Ronnie Penton, who headed up the Deep Horizon thing in New Orleans, that platform blew up. He was one of our team. Our team was headed by Elkin Kirsten. He's a local attorney. And they had serious, serious findings. The federal government would not let our case go to trial, would not let it go to court. And they said the reason was lack of discovery. Well, if you know anything about law, discovery is the stuff you put in to say you can go forward.
Exactly.
We never had a chance to put our stuff forward, and they shut it down. And that was in 2015. I'm old, I'm saying 2015, which I filed it in 2013. Well, it opened up last year because I was running late for church. I sat down and was looking at TV, and they saw advertising about the Oppenheimer movie and the Barbie movie.
Mm.
And so in our research, we knew the Oppenheimer was over. He was actually over the project here in St. Louis.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
So I called my attorney, and we got back on. And so now at least they talk to us sometimes. They don't give, they send it to 15 different places, but they know we're here, and they know they're going to have to do something eventually.
Mm.
So we just fight it,
Yeah. But one of the things I remember when I attended one of the screenings was that they were reluctant to talk about it because it was, quote, national security, which, to me, is no longer valid because we're not in 1956. We're not in the Cold War, and people are dying from the effects of that. Do you all even know what was sprayed on you?
Well, yes and no. There's there's this one substance called cadmium sulfate. And that's a chemical that it's like an iridescent stuff, you know, you can see it. And so they were testing with that, but also put zinc in it. And all of this stuff put together ended up being a cancerous producing solution. But we found it out by Lisa Martino Taylor going and doing research on it. I mean, she's a godsend. And we've uncovered a lot of stuff that was covered. When we first had her doing some things, she went out to the University of Stanford University, and went in and did some research for a day, came back the next day, they stopped at the door and took all her stuff.
Wow.
Never gave it back.
Wow.
So that's telling you something in the notes that she had taken stopped it. So
this is some kind of espionage movie or something.
Oh, yeah.
So if you're just joining us, this is Jamala Rogers here at Voices from the Battlefield, and we're talking to Ben Phillips, who is a victim and a survivor of the poisoning that went on down at Pruitt-Igoe. So we are talking about not just the legacy of a failed housing project. We are now exploring the fact that they were guinea pigs to a chemical poisoning of children. Because you all were seeing this on the playground and stuff, this mist coming down on you. You saw the men in the hazmat suits. And, you know, y'all didn't think nothing of it. Your kids playing
in the dirt. You know, on the playgrounds. They didn't have playgrounds initially at Pruitt-Igoe. So what I'm saying, it was kind of a decent place, but we didn't know we were also getting poisoned.
Yeah. Can you imagine?
And like I said, I found it out in 20, I'm going to 19 again, 2011 was when I first found out about it.
So I'm curious, the person doing the research, how was she able to find out that St. Louis was one of those places that they were experimenting?
It was interesting. She was working, like I said, she was working on a PhD, and she was working at a hospital. She was working at a hospital or a law firm, but there were two young ladies at different times who she became friends of, and they talked about how they had this ailment in their family, and it was cancer. And she said, oh, you know, she felt sorry for the young lady. A second young lady who didn't know the first young lady from Pruitt-Igoe came up to her and talked about the same sort of thing and actually told her about seeing this hazmat suit wearing guys and stuff like that. And Lisa said it was interesting because she got two people from the same spot who didn't know each other had basically the same type of story. So that perked her interest, and she started researching it. And that's how it got started. I mean, it got started on a fluke, and then she realized what was going on later on.
But I'm curious as how she was able to confirm that they even did it, if it was, quote, national security. Was it declassified by that time, or what?
Like the boxes down at Mar-a-Lago?
Yeah.
Stuff happens, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
But she did a lot of research on it, and she kind of knows what were... I consult her often when we hear something. I consult her often.
Mm-hmm.
The Just Moms people in St. Louis County, co-workers, they consult her also.
Okay.
So, and I've been trying to work some things with Just Moms in St. Louis County, Coldwater Creek.
So if St. Louis was one of those places that was a testing ground, what other people got the spray or some other kind of chemical element? Because I'm thinking about some place like Robertson, Missouri, which was a black town at one point, and they were complaining about contamination. And eventually, people think they were moved out of that area because of the impending acreage that the St. Louis Lambert Airport needed, but those folks were also suffering from high rates of cancer. So was there other places in the region that were testing sites as well?
Well, what we have, you got a two-headed devil out here. You got radiation and you have the aerosol.
Ah.
Radiation was what most of this area got. In fact, St. Louis got a double dose. I mean, not St. Louis, Pruitt-Igoe area. We got radiation, and we also got spraying. They were not spraying in other areas in the St. Louis area. What happened with, like, Coldwater Creek, that was a result of them not knowing how to handle nuclear waste. And they dug and put the stuff in the ground around these people, people not knowing, and the barrels leaked. Leaked into the soil, leaked into the water, and stuff like that. And I was, I'm working with these people on some things. They sprayed us. Ours was, we were subjects of an experiment.
Right, absolutely.
Okay, and the, with this fog, we called it the fog. And there's a book by Dr. Lise Martino, Behind the Fog, and it tells you everything about this. But what it was, they put this fog up, and this fog was a stone, brick, penetrating substance. So they weren't going to bomb Russia, underground. They were going to put this stuff up in the air.
And just let it seep through and kill people.
Through the brick and harm the people inside. And that's what they did to us in Pruitt-Igoe, Cross Square Village, all of that area, Malanfi Street, Park Mill Creek. I mean, so it was not a bomb. It was worse than a bomb because the bomb hit one spot, it killed a few people there, and then it's gone. But this fog just lingers.
Yeah. So I'm thinking, though, Ben, if it's a fog and the you won't see the immediate effects like you would a bomb, was there any attempts by the government to periodically talk with people to see what impact was? Did you all ever see people coming back to say, okay, how are you feeling? Have you got any new symptoms here? What's going on with your family?
I've seen no follow-up on research. No follow-up on research.
But that's curious because how will they know if it was effective?
That's our question. That's why we said, if you, what we don't know can hurt us. What you don't know can kill you. And that's where we are. We don't know. We still don't know exactly what they put up in the air. We know a few substances like that I named, like candy and stuff like that, but you know, it's a lot of stuff that we just don't know, and we need to know.
You need to know because that might help you, at least at this point, I don't know how proactive you could be, but certainly the medical folks that, you know, family members might be going to, that might be beneficial for them to say, oh, you were exposed to this, so therefore you're going to start to see these kinds of symptoms, and then it's going to lead to that. I just think that people, the knowledge of knowing is so important.
Well, you know, this stuff could be generational. You know, I have, you know, four kids. Who's to say that I'm past, and also my wife was born in, well, she wasn't born in Pruitt-Igoe, but she lived in Pruitt-Igoe. So she got, they have a mom and a dad who exposed to this stuff. And if it's generational, it could pass on to them, our grandkids. So that's what the lawsuit basis is about. We want to know why us.
So, because at this point you haven't even got to the compensation because you're trying to figure out what was it?
Right.
What happened?
And you know the federal government, you know, I believe, I trust that we're going to get to something for compensation eventually. But it's going to say, if it happens on, say, June 1st, they're going to give us a June 15th to show that we live there or we were there. So we put together plans for that because it looked like it's selling with Coldwater Creek. Knock on wood, I hope they do. And that'd be the first step toward us get some knowledge.
So correct me if I'm wrong. At this point, you all don't even have empirical data about the scope of the damage to the to folks. You all have no knowledge of how many people died prematurely, how many people still have lingering impacts of radiation. You know, it just seems like to me, I don't know how you do an experiment if there's no follow-up. Even though I know it was a negative experiment, I'm just trying to think, okay, you do something and then you follow up and say, oh, okay, that didn't kill them fast enough, so then we're going to increase the whatever.
But Jamala, who's to say that they didn't get research? I didn't receive research answers. They just didn't tell us about it. I mean, they could have been working with the universities, with the hospitals, or whatever, testing people. You know, if I go to the hospital with an ailment, who's to say, oh, this guy, he lived at 2229 O'Fallon. Let's test him to see if he got rabies.
Oh, yeah,
so I don't know that. and we don't know that. Mm. And they're not
sharing that with you, right?
Mm. So, but there had to be some type of research trail that they had, and we're trying to get that.
Does Lisa know why St. Louis, I know you said the BRICS was similar to what they would have in Leningrad and Stalingrad and all those places because of the brick. But there's other places that had brick.
There were other studies. We call them studies. I mean, we don't get no answers, but it's just study. I think Baltimore had the same. A lot of places like in New Mexico where they actually tested the nuclear bomb.
Mm-hmm.
See, all of this comes through the Manhattan Project, mm-hmm. Oppenheimer,
mm-hmm.
the daddy of
it all.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we know that. But the Defense Department, it's not the Department of Energy now, but the Department of Energy wasn't recognized until like the 1990s or something.
Yeah, they weren't the initiators. What would they know? They probably don't even have all the information.
Probably don't. They're the record keeper. They're the record keeper of something. We don't know how much, how far it goes back or how deep it is. So when you start dealing with the government, you know, you got a heck of a whale.
This interesting that it moved from the Department of Defense, which, you know, would make common sense that, okay, it's there, they're testing it for war. But to move it to the Energy Department, that seems to be a stretch.
Well, they supply the gasoline to all the Defense Department vehicles and stuff like that, the planes or whatever.
Yeah,
and
then what's that have to do with the aerosol nature of it? It seems to be like they're just passing the stuff around so they don't really have to deal with it.
What they call it, misdirection?
Yeah. Okay, you're looking at the Department of Defense, and they're like, oh, we don't have nothing to do with that. Now you got to go to the Department of Energy. And they're like, well, what are you talking about? That was 1959.
When I first filed this lawsuit, we got the names of organizations, Monsanto, we had Parsons Engineering, Stanford University. Those are some of the prime contractors or people who were involved in it. Monsanto changed its charter.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of it coming out of St. Louis, it's coming out somewhere out east.
Mm-hmm.
So,
a trick of hand. I mean, these folks are very slick, y'all.
Yeah. Well, we're a brand new company. That was an old company.
Yeah. We had nothing to do with that. Yeah.
Why are you asking us about it? Mm-hmm. The fact where they don't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But the CEO is now director of operations for it, the old CEO.
Surprise. Yeah.
So
these folks are still linked and folks are still dying and we don't know who's dying. I know that you all have reunions of the folks in Pruitt-Igoe.
Right.
So can you tell from the talk at those reunions about, what, at least in an unofficial way, the impact that the testing had on the folks who now know what happened? Because I can imagine if you didn't know what happened, you just think, oh, I got sick, or now I can't breathe, I'm coughing. You just think I'm getting old or whatever. But now that people know, now they're sharing stories. So what are those stories like?
Well, when I talk to people about it, they recognize that there was an inordinate amount of cancer in their families.
Okay.
But like everything, we have to get the story out there, and today is one of those days that we get the story out. I like going on radio. I mean, we have with our session, we have a panel discussion. The one that you saw, I was trying to work this stuff and it wasn't working too good, but you got the gist of what we were
absolutely
doing.
Absolutely.
We're still trying to get the word out there to everybody. I remember the last building was destroyed 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, where are these people? It's hard. You know, we got a Facebook page that would be enacted not too long ago, talk about Pruitt-Igoe, the informational stuff we need for Pruitt-Igoe only.
Okay.
And that way, when you put something on, there's still a Pruitt-Igoe.
Right,
The reunion,
right.
Which we have every Mother's Day Saturday, the Saturday before Mother's Day every year, okay. We have a Pruitt Igoe reunion get together.
Yeah, but some of these stories are gone. Being people are dying. Like, what, you know, so this is also part of a tactic that the U.S. government, they just wait it out and keep, you know, and then people are dying and other folks don't know, don't care.
I'm 74 and a half. I was 5 when I moved down there. They stopped testing us probably by the time I was 12 or 13 at the most. It was more sporadic then. I'm one of the babies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. Everybody, you know, you're going to take me 5 or 6 years. Now, everybody dead who's 80,
yeah.
85 years
yeah.
old.
Because think about the parents of the kids. They're
That's
dead.
That's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's what, yeah. All my friends' parents are dead.
Right.
And we all were 5, 6 years old running mm-hmm. around, you know, doing mud pies and mm-hmm. stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
That stuff
mm-hmm.
seeping into the soil.
And I told people back in the day, we used to eat the mud pies.
Yep.
Because it tasted pretty good. It didn't have all those contaminants in it. It tasted a little sweet. So we were actually eating the pies that we made. So just think about that. Folks eating the soil that was
yeah.
contaminated. So here's a question just based on what you just said, Ben. I'm wondering what role did the St. Louis government have in this? And how are you all making them accountable for some of this? Because they had to have given permission.
Well, that's a big surprise. We don't know because there's no evidence. And, you know, I know people who have been health department for the last 40 years when I was downtown. I was a director. And they heard about it. But they weren't involved with it. I mean, when you start talking about people who were involved with that, they were 100 years old now or better. So I think that there was a thing set in place. When I mentioned hospitals, I'm sure that when people came to the hospital in the emergency or were sick, going out in the Pruitt Igoe area, neighborhood, if they got that zip code, at that time it was just a code, it wasn't
mm-hmm.
a zip code,
mm-hmm.
06, which is Pruitt Igoe. I bet you there was somebody, some hospital, and we had hundreds of hospitals in St. Louis area, who was under contract to find out if that person had a trait of this poison in
mm-hmm.
or whatever. It had to be some type of accountability on their part.
Mm-hmm.
Not to us, but
right,
to
right.
The management of this strain. I believe that happened.
And I believe it happened too, and that somebody has those files, but I'm actually talking about the mayor who would have had to give him some kind of initial approval of this happening in this city. And I was trying to remember who the mayor might have been.
Probably Tucker might have been Tucker.
Okay, so is there some way to go to the source of that? Because maybe in that agreement they stated what they were going to do. And not that if they had been very explicit, say, we want to, because these are poor black folks, we're going to use them as testing victims. I don't think it was that explicit, but I'm sure that it was clear to the mayor who signed off on it that this is happening to people in public housing, and this is
right.
They're basically throwaway, so it's okay for you to go in and do that.
That's what it could have been, because we haven't found. All we've heard is that the city of St. Louis leadership didn't know exactly what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
This was a straight up federal.
Yeah, and under the guise of national security, we could only tell you so much.
Right.
But I would suspect if you are a city leader and somebody's saying they're going to bring some poisonous gas and drop it on your people, what? I would be saying, what? Now tell me again. And if these people get sick, who do I go to for remedy? I mean, I just can't imagine, but I guess I can, because back then they were definitely like moving poor people around, you know, like they were unwanted trash. So I can't.
That was still Jim Crow era.
Yeah, yeah.
What they cared about an African American. In fact, they didn't call us African American.
Right, yeah. The Negroes, they, you know,
right.
We spray them, that's okay. Because this was still part of the whole Negro removal thing. But Negro removal basically meant that you didn't want them in the places where, you know, white middle class people were going to be. So they were going to be, you know, shuttled off to somewhere. But it wasn't supposed to mean physical and literal removal, like we get rid of them. You know, I can't help but thinking back to the bombs of Nagasaki. Most of the chemical and warfare has been targeted by people of color. And even if there are some documents that will say that the bomb dropping was unnecessary, that what they wanted to do with that bomb, because they didn't have a chance to use it because the Japanese surrendered before right. that, was they still wanted to see what the impact was.
Right.
And there's documentation that they didn't have to do that, but they wanted to see what it was going to look like.
They were, and the Japanese were already in the process of kind of surrendering.
Yeah, no, and this was known. But somebody made the decision, let's go ahead and see what this is going to do. We know they're surrendering, but we need to see what this is going to do. We've put a lot of money into this. Let's see what it'll do. And so this is what we got to see.
They didn't drop it on their partner, right?
Nah, not at all. Russia never got the bombs dropped on them. Germany never got the bombs dropped on them.
Right.
So yeah, it's all part of, if you sort of connect the dots, all a part of this, whole racist nature of who gets tested on, who gets the bomb, who gets the radiation.
But you never hear about the results of the test.
Mm.
You know, 6 out of 10 funerals I go to, especially my parents' age,
mm-hmm.
were cancerous related.
Mm.
Something was going on.
Something was going on. It was not a coincidence.
Not a coincidence.
Mm-mm.
Especially when they planned it.
Right.
They
right.
planned this. This is no mistake.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, the other thing that I remember from the film, or maybe then when you all were talking about it, is that you didn't make much of it because at the same time, or not at the same time, but generally there was the trucks from the health department with the mosquitoes. And so you just thought, oh, this is some more of that. It got a different way of doing it. But still there was no communication with the managers of the building to say, we're going to be coming on this day and here's what we're going to be doing. Alert your, tenants. There was no kind of advance notice.
You know, like I said earlier, this is like a two-headed dragon. Contamination was also brought in by trucks and rail. They moved it through the city. Well, back in the 50s and 60s, they didn't have the covering on them. But this stuff goes up in the air and contaminate neighborhoods. That's how Pruitt-Igoe and Court Square and those areas are now involved with the radiation part. That came from Malachrome. And, now they're starting to get some stuff because the St. Louis Moms, Coldwater Creek, found out about it. They did their research. And Josh Hawley decided to do a board deal, a Senate bill on it. And it was open for an amendment. And I jumped on top of it with facts. And we submitted 63106. So hopefully, if that bill passes, we'll know that probably the next month. Maybe we can have some things happen good for Pruitt-Igoe out of that deal.
Yeah, but it makes me think of...
And Cory Bush is involved with it also.
Okay. It makes me think about the health and well-being of the region.
Yeah.
And how much of it has been compromised by testing known and unknown of the citizens, and who's going to be accountable for that?
St. Louis was one of the primary targets. St. Louis was a hot spot. Lisa Martino says that all the time. St. Louis was the favorite spot.
Why?
For testing. Because we were in the center of the country.
Mm.
We had the type of buildings and structures.
Mm.
We had farmland.
Mm.
So it was a win-win for testers of all this radiation chemical.
But I'm sure one of the things that Lisa knows and the rest of us know just because of common sense, when you have aerosol, that stuff is blowing all over the place. It doesn't just stay on the bricks of Pruitt-Igoe.
That's why I recentered my approach to it. It's just saying Pruitt-Igoe. I said the Pruitt-Igoe neighborhood.
Mm.
Because that stuff went all over.
That. Yeah, and it had to even go to other places, like, East St. Louis.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I've been in touch with some people from East St. Louis and trying to get them on board, especially with the radiation part, because all those rail lines over there, they were taking the stuff by train and trucks and moving it back and forth to find a place to bury it.
Mm.
They got burnt when they took it to Coldwater Creek because the stuff started leaking.
Mm.
And so it was right there in front of their face.
Wow. And to me, the kind of time, I mean, I've been following the Coldwater thing. They've been dealing with this for years, really just sounding the alarm and trying to get some attention. And finally, you know, this looks like it's going to be some movement. But, you know, I think about the other places, the folks in Robertson, Missouri, what happened to them? How are they faring health-wise? The folks who were at, what was the other one? Times Beach. Like we got all of these spots where people were literally communities decimated.
That's where Lisa Martino cut her teeth. Times Beach. She and her husband Steve Taylor. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, they are veterans at research.
Right.
The federal government knows them, and the federal government doesn't like them.
Surprise, surprise.
Right. But, you know, I'm hoping people come to the History Museum on July 11th.
Okay, and we'll keep plugging that, because I think if people see it, and this young man did such an exemplary job of pulling it all together so it's clear, the visuals are clear, the interviews are powerful, you know, you just don't want to miss it. But the other part is, it probably is affecting you in some kind of way, you and your family, because, I mean, the whole quality of air, the quality of life had to be compromised by all of the stuff going on and our communities being vulnerable to it, because obviously there was nobody there to protect us, nobody advocating, oh, you don't want to do that. Nobody was in the way of these testing.
So one thing I want to bring up before I get off here, and I'm going to go back to what you just answered that. But Lisa's book is called Behind the Fog. That's her book.
Behind the Fog.
Lisa Martino Taylor. But also, when I first filed this lawsuit, a good friend of mine who's an attorney, a big shot attorney, he asked me, who did I have with me? I said, I initially filed it by myself. I made it into a class action suit because I said, you know, I got all these friends and stuff who suffer this.
Mm-hmm.
I want to let everybody, if we're going to get some, everybody
needs to get it. That's right. Everybody needs to get it.
Everybody needs to get some. But the guy asked me, said, man, are you crazy? I found this lawsuit? I said, well, I don't think I'm crazy. I said, but hell, with all that stuff they were spraying on me, I could be crazy. So.
Well, you seem to have been of sound mind and body all the time that I've told you. You've been in positions of responsibility, so I think you always acted. But I do want to say, other than the hearing problem, how is your health and your wife's health?
Pretty good. Yeah, I mean, we have the regular old folks
stuff. But I was just curious as how maybe some families got it more than others.
Yeah.
So that would be, to me, the whole understanding of the nature of the fog, the mist, like who was able to repel it? Was it based on what they had in their house? Was it based on their DNA that they were able to repel it? It would just be interesting to know those things.
My estimation is that they probably stayed in the house more than other folks.
That too, yeah.
And they didn't spray every night. It wasn't like something blowing all the time.
Right.
And they did it at night mostly.
Mm.
In the evening, so they were inconspicuous.
Yeah.
But
sneaky.
Well, that's how they roll.
Right. Yeah. Well, Ben, this has been fascinating, and it's not going to end here. On July 11th, people can go to the History Museum to check out exactly what we're talking about and ask. Ask questions free of charge. You can ask questions because we don't have the ability to answer questions, but you get a chance to. We were asking them at the last time we were at the Rock, and so this is an issue that I think affects St. Louis, and I would really like to know the role of city government in this, because I know that they had to have signed off on it, but the fact that it was poor folks in a housing project, it gave little thought to the implications of it. But when you live in a city, all of us are connected. So those people who are in Ladue, you know, those people who were in Central West End living in gated communities, we don't know with that mist, you know, made its way over there? I mean,
the radiation.
Radiation and the, yeah, absolutely. So this is to be continued. Thank you, Ben, for joining us. If you missed any of the sessions or you want to go back and listen to this one again, just go to JamalaRogers.com. We certainly have all of that available for you. If you haven't seen The Black Reps Timbuktu, you gotta see it. It's got, I think, another week. Man, it is fantastic. This is the first time I've seen in a long time they had a pit orchestra. I mean, it's pretty amazing, acting and the costumes, everything. So if you haven't seen it, please do. We're going to be getting ready for all the voter education going on. We got a big, lots of elections coming up. So we definitely want, you know, you all to be a part of that. You know, we got to be woke, y'all. Lots of stuff is going on. And we don't have the same issues that we had with Pruitt-Igoe, where we didn't have social media. People couldn't communicate. We got more than we can work with now. So this is Jamala Rogers, your host. I'll see you on the battlefield.
We have the power.